Now, I know I said I only had one page of notes, but I only actually covered one reference. So we may have a few more parts. Okay, because I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 more references to go, so who knows? All right. Some of them are only 2 or 3 verses. They're not whole chapters, so that they may go a little quicker. All right, so this is the afterburn. This is where you get to come up with your questions and have comments or whatever about what we just received here, what the teaching was. And so if you're online, you can start typing those things in. The Shamash team will make note of those things, as I've got Shamash Kurt and Shamash Rob back there. Okay, if you're here, you can line up. We have a podium and a microphone. All right, and we'll begin with Ashley.
I have 2 questions. The first one is all desire a form of lust?
No. The thing is, well, it's another way of using the word lust, okay? But the thing is, we normally think of lust as being a negative thing. So it's a desire that would end up being negative. We would call that desire lust. Desire, though, is you can have good desires. You desire the kingdom.
Okay,
you desire to hear the words, well done, good and trustworthy servant. You can desire lots of good things. So desire in itself is not the problem. You got to be aware of, is your desire from the above and in line with the above, or is it from the earthly, demonic, fleshly stuff? Okay.
And then my second question is, how does one become joyful in the power of no or correction when their desire is the opposite? Like, and I mean it on a deep level, like when you can correct me inside, I'm like, oh, shaken up and broken up. But I don't want to be shaken and broken up. I want to be like, yay, cool. Okay, I get a new tool and move on.
All right. So, I get that. So look, first of all, it says that nobody enjoys correction when you're first getting the correction. So it's okay not to enjoy it initially. All right. But then when you have time to calm down, you realize that it's going to bear the peaceable fruit, right? And so don't be so hard on yourself that, hey, if I give you correction, for example, and you're not like, oh, that's so great. That's not normal for people to feel that way. When James says to count to joy in a trial, it's not like you're going to count to joy like the second it hits, okay? But once you calm down from the initial smack of whatever the correction is or the trial is, you should be able to count a joy, realizing, okay, this is going to build growth in me. I'm going to learn patience. I'm going to learn this. I'm going to learn that. I'm going to overcome some fear. Whatever it is, right? I'm going to learn to obey. I'm going to learn to submit. Then you can count a joy because you realize there's going to be a benefit. The initial smack is still going to hurt. Okay. And it's okay to feel that pain to some level. But when you get a chance to calm yourself down, and hopefully over time that happens quicker and quicker, then you could realize, hey, this ultimately is for my good.
Okay? It depends on the smack.
Well, it depends on the smack. But I'm just saying is nobody gets smacked. I think it'd be a little weird if you got smacked. You're like, oh, good, you know?
Well, I mean it as in a way because it goes further than that, and this will probably be a Tuesday too thing, but it goes further than that. I think it because my history, and don't stop smacking me, and I know you won't, but I'm saying that because I don't want you to stop smacking me when I do something wrong. But I start the whole psychobabble stuff in my head. And that's the part I want to disconnect as soon as possible. Like, because that's why I'm like, that's what I want to replace it with, the joyfulness instead of turning it
back. All right. So the best way to go about that is to first try to work on how fast or to increase the speed with which you calm down. Okay? And that's where you take the cycle babble that's going on and you say, shh. We're overreacting right now to the initial emotional smack or whatever. So let's calm down. All right? And then think about when your child hurts themselves or something happens, the child's all screaming and upset, and you pick them up, and what's the first thing you're trying to do? Calm them down. They can't receive anything until they calm down. So first, you got to calm them down. So work on the speed with which you can bring yourself back into a place of calm.
Okay.
All right. But the way we do that is, what do you do with a child to calm them down? You give them comfort and reassurance that it's going to be okay, right? You pick them up, you say, it's okay, it's going to be okay. So you just got to do the same thing yourself. Wow, Rabbi just smacked me or whatever. And you say, look, but it's going to be okay. It's all right. I just need to calm down so I can process it properly. Okay? Okay, you're welcome. Look, and this whole desire lust thing, look, husbands and wives, you should desire each other. So desire can be good. Okay, you should desire good things for your family. I mean, there's lots of things that you can desire that are good. So it's not, desire itself is not the problem. What you're desiring could be the problem. Okay, is it in line with the above in terms of the desire for you? Because the above has a lot of desire for you too. They desire, Yahweh desires you to be successful in coming into the kingdom. Okay, so don't necessarily always connect desire and lust, although lust is a desire. But lust is desiring something that's not good for you. Okay, something you should not have. All right, oh, you want to come back up? All right, grab the mic.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand this and not thinking one way and then leaving here being wrong. So then, lust is about the act. I thought lust was more than just that. Or am I taking
no,
a different
I'm saying lust is desiring something that you should not have.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so you desire, okay, you desire your husband. Okay, if you start desiring someone not your husband, that's lust. You see? So that, you understand what I'm saying? If you desire, you know, some good healthy food when you're hungry, that's one thing, because you're, hey, I'm really looking forward to it. This is my favorite food, whatever. But if you're desiring a shrimp cocktail, that could be lust. Because some of you have some very strange, unclean things that you loved, okay? Whatever it was. That would then be lust, okay? Because I know that there are times where I look really forward and desire a certain type of food. And there's nothing wrong with that food. That's fine. So again, when you desire something that's not appropriate and that's not good for you, that's where it turns into lust. Okay? Is that a good definition? Does that work for everybody? Okay, good. All right, Isaiah.
Thanks, Rabbi. Also, like in the Strong's, I've dug up that word. And it says, if I remember right, an overwhelming desire, usually with a negative connotation, which is basically what you just said.
Exactly.
I appreciate that you brought up Rosh Kodesh, because I've had this question burning about that. Because on the Rosh Kodesh, we quote Isaiah 66.
Right.
I'm going to read it because I don't know the wording exactly.
Well, it says from Shabbat, Shabbat, and from Rosh Kodesh to Rosh Kodesh, all flesh will come before me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I know and understand, I receive your instruction already that it is not a Shabbat. Are we required to assemble on the Rosh Kodesh?
Look, it doesn't give us details. And by the way, this is one of those things that we understand from the Creator, that when he knows, well, not when he knows, when he wants us to do anything, he does actually give us very specific instructions. I mean, you look at Leviticus 23, and he lists out all the Sabbaths. He tells you, this is Passover. Then right after Passover, you have unleavened bread. And by the way, the first day of that is a Sabbath. By the way, the last day of that is a Sabbath. Like, he tells us these things. Rosh Kodesh is never referred to that way. Now, there are some verses that get a little confusing. Like, there is a verse that talks about in Amos about how they're waiting for the gates to be open. Okay, but that's talking about temple, and it's talking about other things. And there's another place where it's talking about the Sabbath and the Rosh Kodesh, which could be most likely talking about trumpets, which is the Sabbath and Rosh Kodesh. Okay, but we have to be careful we're not extrapolating out something that generally, in the past, all throughout Scripture, he enumerated very clearly. You shall not work on this day. He says that about 7 days. He says about the first day of unleavened bread and the last day of unleavened bread. And then he says about Shavuot, says it about trumpets, says about atonement, says it about the first day of Sukkot, and he says about Shemini Atzeret. And he words it exactly the same. You shall do no servile work, etc., etc. It'll be a Sabbath of rest. Now, he never says that about Rosh Kodesh. But it is an important thing for us to keep, because it reminds us time is moving and where we are in time, so that we don't miss a feast. So we know what month we're in, what moon we're in. So we have to keep track. So he says, celebrate these things so that you actually are marking them. Because most things that are celebrations, we mark on our calendars so that we don't miss them. You know, it could be an anniversary, it could be whatever it is that you want to celebrate. You mark it so that you don't miss it. He says, celebrate, pay attention to when these Rosh Kodeshes come up so that you celebrate them. Okay. Now, he doesn't tell us how to do it.
Yeah, and I understood the silver trumpet in Numbers 10 to be for gathering.
Right. Of the silver trumpets are simply announcing the gathering for the new moon. I mean, that's the one thing he does tell us. Blow the silver trumpets.
Yeah.
Okay?
All right. And then one other thing, if I can. Sure. Which has nothing to do with that. You were speaking on the power of the tongue and taming the power of the tongue and connected that to desire. That no one can control their desire. And I think you were just paralleling that to what he said, that no one can tame the tongue. But then it does lead us to show, or lead the wording leads to show that we can tame our tongue and that we can become perfect, complete, and whole in Torah by doing so. In my mind, I connected it immediately to this scripture that I know in 1 Thessalonians 4, 3. It's about 3-7, but it says, "For this is the desire of Elohim, your set-apartness, that you should abstain from whoring, that each one of you should know how to possess his own vessel and set-apartness in respect." That verse 4 there. And you said that you should control your desire. You should know how to control and tame your desire. Understanding, you know, thank you, Ashley, that lust is not desire. The two are not the same. Lust can be desire, but it's a negative desire with an overwhelming thing that you're not controlling.
Let's make it simpler. Lust is a form of desire, but not all desire is lust. Okay?
There you go.
That makes it simple. Just so, yes, lust absolutely is a desire, but not all desire is lust. Okay?
Yeah. I guess I just want to comment. I'm saying I'm thankful a lot for your teaching because it's helped put things in perspective. Because with me, I wasn't really raised to understand desire and all those things. And then coming into Christianity, it was like you got to be ashamed for all and every bit of your desire. It's yeah. So, but knowing how to possess your own vessel and set apartness and respect. It means really just putting away everything that is lust, you know, and understanding that, like, so all my desire becomes centered in Yahweh. So I don't know if you can comment on that or add
yes.
to that.
Yes, okay. I like that you brought this up because this is something I guess I didn't really get to express in the teaching, okay? When you mentioned, and you're right, I did say it this way, that, you know, we can't control our desires. Remember, it talks about the lusts of the flesh, right? Okay. So it says lust of the flesh. So in the below, if you're in that mindset, the flesh, the earthly, demonic, the below, you can't control it. Your lust drive. It takes the above being coming, brought into you to control that. Okay. So when you connect to and seek to emulate and be like the above, you can control these things. And that's what I think he's talking about when he talks about, like, the wisdom from above, okay? So as long as we're in the flesh, the lust is going to win and drive. Because they're the lusts of the flesh. They're not the lusts of the above, okay? And so I'm glad that you got to say that. That's how I would clarify that, saying that, yes, as long as you're in flesh, you're not going to control the lust. Your lusts are going to win out. But it's when you're vertically connected and trying to be in the above mindset that you can control these things. So yes, they are controllable, but not if you're in the flesh. Okay, good.
Thank you.
All right, Janet.
So the way I see you, when I see you, whether you're teaching us or in counseling, you really are a rock. And that's how safe I feel if I'm using your words, because I do use a lot of the words, especially what you did say about trauma last Shabbat, and how my clients are like, oh my gosh, that was so good. That wasn't me, that was my rabbi. I do give credit to you. Because you really, no, you really are very good.
Thing I get 10%.
Yes, gladly and more because I get so much from it, you know. I don't understand 50% only tithing. I just don't get that. That's a different topic, right? But I do have a question about. Actually, I connected what you said about ready to receive, right? To that, passage from Yeshua, from Matthew, when he was saying, you know, that, you know, truly I say, unless you turn and become as little children, right, you shall by no means enter into the reign of heavens. And so you said something about being a teacher and how you don't take it. So you have that responsibility and there's no fear, but you have the reverence because you have, we're going to follow what you're going to say, right? If we receive it. So when I'm upstairs, I have that some level of fear because the children, like it says here, they really are ready to receive.
Right. And so for people watching, so when you say you're upstairs, when you're working with our children's program is upstairs.
Yes.
Okay.
So the children are ready to receive. So I have this tremendous responsibility. But I'm glad that we have an awesome program. Everything is aligned to what you're saying. And if I don't have an answer, I will say, well, that's an answer for Rabbi. That's way here, and wish you could come once and answer all their questions because they have a lot of questions. But I do have that level of fear when I'm there. Is that a good fear? Because you say that we need to overcome fear.
Totally.
Okay. All right. Now.
Okay. So remember, there's a fear like being afraid of something as opposed to an awe and reverence for a situation and recognizing the level of responsibility.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm always aware when I counsel, when I teach, that there's a responsibility that I need to have a reverence for, that if I say it and I expect you to do it and you expect to get the word from him through me, I've got to really be aware of that always, okay? And I know Elder feels that way, I know Rabbi Tom feels that way when they share things, that they're doing the best they can. Of course, they have an added layer. They try to think about, okay, what would Rabbi say and what has he taught about this? Because that's kind of the structure, right? And then if they're not sure what to do, then they pass it to me, okay? And so that's kind of the way it should work. But it's not, I don't want it to be like a fear, like, you know, but it's not an anxiety either. It's just an awareness of having respect for the level of responsibility.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah. And so my question is about discipleship,
with,
tied to this whole ready to receive, ready to obey, don't argue with. So discipleship is beyond just listening to you, if I'm understanding correctly, is actually seeking counsel, following counsel, is trying to not just assume that you know something, but come with the questions to make sure that the teacher is clarifying or, you know, giving the right ruling or whatever, right understanding of what we're reading. Can you expand on what discipleship looks like for us practically,
today,
you know, like here, like up at Shalom? Thank you.
Okay, so a lot of people do ask, you know, from time to time about wanting to be discipled, okay? Now, of course, in Yeshua's day, this would be something where people would live together and they travel around and, you know, they all were with him all the time. And they would learn as he instructed. They would also learn by watching him, okay? And seeing how he handled different things. Elders getting the closest thing to a discipleship because he's with me more than anybody and hears what I say and answers how and sees how I handle different things, and that's a discipling type of thing, okay? But for the rest of you with modern technology, the teachings are discipling tools. What makes it discipling or not is whether or not you're ready to obey. Are you ready to receive? See, if it's just information, you're not being discipled. It's like sitting in a classroom, some teacher's talking, and you're like, all right, whatever, okay? And you're going to learn the subject to pass the test or whatever the course is. But if you're actually listening to that teacher as an Ephesians 4:11 teacher, and you are ready to receive, then you are likely being discipled in a more modern sort of sense with the technology we have today, because now it's not practical. You know, he only walked around with 12 guys. There's thousands of you, right? Now, he did talk to thousands when he would sit at times and, you know, do things like the Sermon on the Mount, etc. But generally, he discipled just the small group. We can actually, with technology, disciple a whole lot more frequently. Part of that is the teachings. The other part, like you said, and I also mentioned with elders, that the counseling and watching and seeing how I handle different things. Also, a lot of this Q&A stuff, the Zoom sessions when we do the zones, is very much a discipleship, potentially, type of opportunity. It's potentially a discipleship thing, because if you're paying attention and watching how the teacher is handling, people's questions, people's situations, and what they're doing. This is a discipling type of thing. Then, of course, what do disciples always get to do? They got to ask Yeshua questions. So you get to ask me questions. So again, this does fulfill a lot of the functional things of discipleship. So what makes the difference? And I don't think I've ever said it this way before, so pay attention. How you receive. Okay? Otherwise, you're just somebody listening to teachings. But if you're someone listening to teachings and you're receiving, without arguing, without fighting, then you're discipling. Okay? So you get to decide, actually, whether or not you're discipling with me. It's not about me. Back then, you'd have to actually, the way it used to work, not with Yeshua, he was the exception. The way it worked with everybody else, because people would disciple in terms of fishing or carpentry or anything. You could disciple. It really was a mentorship thing, right? It's basically you would go up to somebody and say, I would love to disciple with you. Would you be my teacher? And that person didn't have to take you. And if they did, then they were agreeing to this relationship where I'm now responsible to make sure that I've given you everything I can in this thing we're discipling about, and you're responsible to receive. That's the contract. Yeshua was different. He went and picked his guys. Okay, they didn't pick him, he picked them. But in all other situations, it would work the other way. So people have come to me and asked me to disciple them. I said, I don't have the ability or time to do it in a Yeshua-like manner, to have people be here. Some of you think, well, I'm going to move there and Rabbi will be able to. I don't have time for that. You can move here and you'll get to spend more time than maybe you wouldn't otherwise. And you get to see me during the oneg and other situations and watch how I deal with people. But also, you'll get to sit with me and ask questions and have the counselings and stuff. But really, the teachings would be primary. I mean, Yeshua wanted them, when he sent them out at the end of Matthew, to go and teach what he taught them. And so if you take the teachings that come from me that way, then you could be discipling with me. Because people ask me about discipleship. I said, if I had a formal program, you know what I would first do? I'd make you listen to all the teachings. I'd make you listen to all the teachings. If I had a formal program. Because that's the main point, is that you understand what I have been given to give to people to understand. So that then hopefully at some point you could also share that information. I mentioned the four levels that I use, not the four levels like Peshat, Ramesh, Drash, and Sod. The four levels that I make teachings is, one, that you understand the material. Two, that you are doing the material. Like, you understand it enough, now you're doing it. Three, that you're able to defend why you've chosen to do or not do based on the teaching. Because you know the verses and you know how to defend your decision to do that. Then four, that you can now potentially share and teach it. By the way, to get to that level, you probably need to study a teaching, not just listen to it. By the way, you should know there's a difference between studying something and listening to it. Okay? A lot of you listen to the teachings. Some of you study some of the teachings, but to disciple, you need to study every teaching. You should be able to know, just like we quote what Yeshua said, or John said, or James said, or Paul said, or Moses said, or whoever, you should be able to quote what I say, if I'm your discipler. Elder does it all the time. I hear him on the phone. I'm sure Rabbi Tom does too. He's just in a different building, so I didn't get to hear him all the time, okay? But you would be quoting your teacher. Okay, well, Rabbi says this and Rabbi says that. But you should know what I said, because when I quote the above, I actually quote to you what they said. I'm not just telling you that he whispered in my ear something. I read it to you. And so when they quote me, they know the teaching that, hey, you can go listen to it too. This is what Rabbi says. Okay. And of course, the reason I said it is because of what they told me, what they have here, and my understanding of it, right? So yes, discipleship is something all of you theoretically could be doing right now. All right? All right, Chris?
When I was reading the part in James that you were teaching about the bridle and the horse, I was thinking about this movie from the 70s, The Black Stallion.
Right.
I don't know if you know that one, where goes on fire, and there's the boy and the horse, this Arabian black horse, mm-hmm. and it's wild as wild is. And I was thinking how that compares to like what we think of horses today, where we see farms and they're all kind of, you know, they've been tamed, I guess, through their breed, or I don't know much about horses. But back then, I'm thinking in James's day that a lot more horses were just really wild, and the island, the boy is able to over time, tamed the horse. Not all of a sudden, and it was a lot of fear and learning trust, I guess, over the horse. But that just came to mind. And also in, I was thinking about Psalm 32 in verse 8, let me instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. Let me counsel, my eye be on you. Do not be like the horse, like the mule, with no understanding, with bit and bridle, else they do not come near you, because they won't come near you if you're not, if they've not been tamed, if they've not submitted right to your teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my comment on that. Just I'm thinking about like a wild horse that needs to be tamed versus the kind of horses that I guess we see that they're all nice and I don't know what horses are like.
I'm not an expert on this at all, but I mean, from what I understand, you know, when you put the bit in their mouth, if you pull on it, it can cause them some pain. So when we're talking about you use the bridle to turn the head of the horse and guide it, is because if you don't go where I want you to go, it's going to hurt a little bit. Isn't that the kind of thing that we need from above? Like, he does things that says, look, if you're not going to turn the way I want you to turn, it's gonna, or you, I want you to stay straight and you want to turn and you're pulling on that thing to say, no, we're not going that way, it could hurt a little bit. Okay. Now, over time, once you have tamed the animal, you can go to a softer bit and it's not going to hurt them because they already have been tamed. But initially, you pull on that, it's going to be like, oh, I need to just, yeah, okay? And so Abba gets our attention often through things that are emotionally, if nothing else, painful. Okay?
Yeah, and I think that really fits in with what James is talking about with teachers and leadership throughout the whole chapter. I had a question about verse 1 with it talks about not being teachers, and I'm always very afraid of saying anything, especially online, that could be thought of as teaching. But I'm also, like some people are have a gifting toward different kinds of creation, whether it's movies or art, or I like to write a lot, and so I've made a blog, and I'm focusing on non-scriptural things to talk right about. And I think of scripture and kind of halakha as being a fairly self-contained part of things to talk about. But there's also kind of more generally personal development or other kinds of teaching that you do that I feel can be applied in different ways. But I don't want to overstep on anything in a blog setting that might be public. I guess I like writing publicly, I suppose.
Sure.
And so I'm trying to see if that's a desire, like a lust, or not.
No, so. It may be a good desire. The thing is, look, it is always in your best interest, whatever you and anybody else, it's always in your best interest that anything you're doing that you're reluctant because it may be potentially an issue is to go up whatever vertical you're in. Like, you may be in an industry and you're putting something out that you're not sure is right. Look, just now, when I was talking about the bridle, I looked over at my horse person and made sure I was giving the right information because I know somebody who knows something about horses, okay? So you look for confirmation to know that you're giving the right information. So if you wanted to write some stuff, then you could always go up your whatever vertical that would be and say, hey, could you look at this and make sure it's okay? And then you get approval, and then it's okay to do, okay? Because I know I would tell everybody, look, it's always good or approved to quote me. But you know what the problem is? You don't quote me correctly. So it's more important that you, before you do that, you run it by me to make sure you're quoting me correctly. I've had several people say, well, you know, in this teaching over here, you said this, and I didn't. I said, fine, go find it. Let's give me the timestamp. We'll go play it back, and I didn't say it. But that's what they interpreted. So you got to be really careful. Are you quoting me correctly, or you're quoting what you thought I said or what you thought I meant, right? So that's if I'm your discipler. Look, if you're in a different industry, before you throw something out there, you may want to look at someone who's an expert in whatever it is before you throw something out there and embarrass yourself, okay? All right, Ken, who is not a former pastor, but is a bishop at all times. His last name is Bishop. I said he was a former pastor when he wasn't, but he said he has been his whole life a bishop, though.
I think that was appropriate to let everybody know. I have done, a few people came up, I didn't know you were a pastor.
No, but you have been a bishop your whole life.
I've been a bishop.
Yeah.
I'm just glad I never made bishop.
Yeah, I was wondering if that ever would have been a weird thing. Bishop, would you come up here and do the sacraments or whatever? Yeah. I don't know.
That's right.
Okay.
We're together. We're walking in unison. I was really glad that you touched the way you did on there at the end of the teaching when we were comparing our walk with the mainstream. And it's, I sort of want to, I got up to make a statement about that. And then you also answered Isaiah in a way that was complimentary to what I think I'm going to bring up, where you were mentioning the, if you're in the below, and you're not going to see, but if you're in the above, you're going to receive. So I was thinking about these this teaching, but where it starts out on in verse 17, you know, where we're saying everything from wisdom from above and all those good things, and I'm recalling before we found this walk that we were part of the church system, which I'm also guessing the vast majority of everybody here. Nobody was born into this. It's still fresh and new, and from the standpoint of a seed that's been planted and growing. But I have examples of in my own experience where these very same verses, and I checked also while I was waiting to come up, I checked some other translations, and they're almost word for word what we're seeing in ISR.
Sure.
So it's very curious to me, why would those teachers in the mainstream continue to use this book to teach the way they are, and the people that receive that are accepting that and not even questioning it. And, of course, that probably has a lot to do with having your bubble pop. But there's got to be examples of people who have read this and simply choose to say, well, we're receiving the good news and you guys are off the edge and you're a cult, but yet we see it because we have more pieces that are fitting together to show this is the truth, the way, and the life. And so what was my point? I guess
I was going to ask the same question.
I was thinking, I made such a good presentation. What was my point? No. Maisie, where was I going?
Listen, this is not like, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? You don't get to phone a friend, okay? You want to poll the audience to see if anybody wants to guess your point? Okay.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to sit down and embarrass me.
That's fine.
You know, it's one of those things, you'll probably come to me and I'll come running back up.
That's fine. You can do that. You have my permission. But, after all, you are a bishop, so.
Oh, it's starting to come. It's really close.
All right, well, you can have a seat and come back up. It's not a problem. We'll go to Angela, and then you can come back up. Okay, when you get that all percolated or whatever you need to do, and then you can come back up. All right. Angela, go ahead.
I wonder if you could help me understand. I think I'm a little confused. We're supposed to take everything to Abba in prayer and supplication.
Yep.
And I'm unique in that I've been in this walk since I was 3 years old. Maybe just a remnant. And I took a long break from it. But all the hardships I've been through, I developed a relationship directly with Abba. And so I go to him anytime, all the time, over everything. but we're supposed to come to you also. So where's that line for me? Because he does talk to me. He has helped me with a lot of things directly.
Yeah, and look, the line is very simple. If you're not getting the answer, just through prayer. I mean, you know, if you spent enough time, and it sounds like you have, since yours goes back a lot longer than maybe a lot of people's, you have verses and things that he can stir to remembrance to kind of help you when you're dealing with something, and then you get some answers. But there's always going to be those moments where you're not getting answers, okay? And so those are the moments when you go and seek the help. Now, you're going to need to do that a whole lot more when you're new and a whole lot less down the road, right? Just like a child needs your help doing a bunch of stuff that later on they never need your help with anymore because they could do it themselves, right? And so they end up needing different kind, like remember I talk about all you guys who have children, you're supposed to shift from parenting to counseling, to being an advisor. So that's really what, at this point, you don't need parenting. A lot of new people need more like parenting, like I don't know how to do anything. What do I do? Okay, which is, that's like a child needs. I need to know what I should eat, what I can't eat, what can I do, what days do I keep. I mean, you don't know anything, all right? But at this point for you, it's more like more nuanced things that come up, and I'm not really sure what to do with these things. This is more Deuteronomy 17 level, like a matter you don't know what to do, then you would seek counsel. That would be a less frequent thing, okay?
Okay, so a follow-up to that. Sometimes you say things from the mic that I feel are directly pointed at me, but I've taken it to Abba and I have an answer from him. Should I then seek to counsel with you and share that with you?
Only if you have a lack of clarity. If you feel like you got the answer. I mean, I'm not here to judge whether or not you're getting the answer. So you don't need to come and double check things with me if you feel like you got your answer. You know, as long as the answer is not going to be something that puts you at odds or in conflict with me, then there's probably a confusion that needs to be clarified, right? But if you get an answer that's like, oh, I see why Rabbi said this and how it affects me and how I should boast, that's fine, okay?
I might need to counsel with you so I can share something with you.
Well, good, okay. Yeah, I mean, because sometimes things, and by the way, nothing's directed at anybody. Although he's directing things, he knows which ones of you really need to hear different pieces of whatever comes out. And so if you feel like something's directed at you, it is, not from me necessarily, right? But the question is, if something hits you and you're like, ooh, you might not know what to do with that, then you might pray about it and he might say, I got your attention, good, this is what I wanted you to get out of that. Or you may not get that answer, maybe you're thinking, I have a problem with Rabbi now or what he said. Well, then you might need to come talk to me so we can clean that up, okay? All right. You get your answer, Ken?
Take two.
Okay, good.
Yeah, this is my question.
My question is, why did you walk around that way to walk around this way to walk back that way? Just so you can get more time on the camera? I mean, you could have just walked back four feet instead of down.
This is my walk. This is the way I walk.
Right.
So, yeah, I thought I had the answer. Is it no? No, my question it relates to after being here for over 4 years now, I can look back and see these things where I came from. And so I'm wondering if we knew, me among anybody else that sees it this way, we came out of something. And we overcame that being in the world, in the below. We overcame that sense that we were doing something correct. And we now look and see we were not correct, and we can accept that and believe it. Is that overcoming a spirit of Hasatan? That's kind of a question. And if so, do we not owe ourselves a pat on the back that we were able to overcome that? And are growing, and that we are witnesses to ourselves, but also to those that are there. I mean, is it something that I can say, I've overcome that desire to be right in that system, and I'm humbled enough to know that I can't boast about that, but I'm humble enough to know that this is where I want to be, and that's a positive, that's a success.
Yes. All right. So, first of all, Hasatan, I think, has two desires. One is he wants to cheer you on in doing what you shouldn't do. And, of course, that means that the more that you're in a system that keeps you from being where you're supposed to be, the more he's happy about that. So you are overcoming somewhat of a Hasatan mindset when you get set free from the system that's keeping you in part truth, not all truth, and therefore you're not really going to be where you need to be. Now, the other part is, I'm not so sure about the idea of patting on the back. You should be feeling a certain level of proper pride that he called you knowing you could, and you actually did. Okay? So you should feel proud of yourself that you, because some of you got on this path thinking, I can't do this, and then you actually found a way to start really doing it. And so you should feel good that you're now learning to believe him more because he believed you could do it even when you didn't believe you could do it. And so, yeah, you should give yourself a little bit of a pat on the back, so to speak, but it's a proper feeling good, hey, I'm getting this, I've overcome something, and I can keep building on that. So, yes, okay, absolutely. All right, Maisie.
I have a question about Yaakov 3:16, which says, for where jealousy and self-seeking are, there is confusion in every foul deed. Would it be fair to say that an overabundance of fear and doubt can lead to those things, like they would be emotional drivers?
Well, okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, look, jealousy, what does jealousy come from? A fear that someone has something that you don't have or has something you want or is getting some attention that you think you should. So it's a fear that you're not. It's not just jealousy, well, they have it, I don't. There's also this fear that you're not going to get it, that you should get it. And so you're afraid you'll never have it because somebody else stole it or got it when you should have, whatever. There's a fear under there, possibly, absolutely, okay? And then as far as the self-seeking, again, a lot of times the self-seeking is to overcome or compensate for fear or for insecurity, more insecurity, which is a type of fear, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Live stream. You have 3 minutes.
All right. Shamish Giri has a question. James 3:61. I think we view this
61. As... There's no verse 61. Is okay.
It? Maybe it's 16. Maybe I got backwards. Yeah. It was as a text.
Well, go ahead. Read the rest of it, and I'll.
All right. So, I think we view this as just an individual. However, since the context is about teachers, would this be referring to the defiling of the body, as in the body of Messiah? Hence, the double judgment on teachers.
3:6. Yes.
3:6. 3:6. What it is?
It was from 3:6. All right. So. Among our members, the tongue is set, and the one defiling the entire body. Yes. Yeah, that interpretation is fine. Okay? So, my answer is yes.
Okay. From Abraham Nixon. Hold on. Okay. He says, Shalom, Rabbi, if I'm asked about tzitzit, not working on a Shabbat, etc., am I... answers lead to more questions. Where's the line between a conversation and teaching? I don't want to step into the wrong role.
Okay, so again, sharing information, just got to be, you know, clear. As long as it's just simple, straightforward, or you know that you're accurately quoting something, okay, that's sharing information. It's not necessarily teaching. If the person's starting to argue with you and you're starting to make a case back and forth, you could be stepping into that. But just, again, it's not that you shouldn't answer any questions, okay? But you got to just be very clear in your own emotional state to know, I have to be really confident that the information I'm sharing is correct, that I'm quoting the book correctly, or I'm quoting Rabbi correctly, I'm quoting, that I'm making, doing something that I'm confident is actually correct. Okay, so someone asks you about your tzitzit. Let's say they're asking, like, why do you wear them? And if you say, look, in Numbers 15, verse 37, the next couple of verses, it says, you know, that we're to wear these tzitzit to remind us to keep the commandments. Well, that's accurate, and you can pull up the verse or whatever. That's fine. You could also mention, by the way, the woman with the issue of blood in Matthew 9, which she also reached out for Yeshua's tzitzit. Okay, well, there you go. All right. So that being said, you know, you have you know, let's say they're asking you a question like, well, why do you wear the white and the blue? Well, because my rabbi teaches me don't only wear the white with the blue. And so you can have it that way. So it's not that you should never teach. I mean, obviously, one of the things I want you to do is I want you to get to the point where you can answer the questions, you know, when people ask them. Because if you listen to the teachings enough, you should be able to get to the fourth level, right, where you are actually able to teach it. But I want you to have a proper reverence and awe for the fact that if I'm shifting into a teaching role, I could be putting myself in a place where there's a higher judgment, right? So if you're asked about anything that you do, why don't you work on Saturday? You can answer the question. You're not teaching unless they start asking you to give you all the details of Sabbath observance. Then you might want to say, you know what? I have a rabbi. He's my teacher. He's got a teaching on it called this, whatever the Sabbath teaching was. I think it was just called Sabbath at this point, Shabbat, where the first one was called Remember the Sabbath Day. But just, you know, you could point to a teaching, okay? And always, if they're really interested, they should want to speak to the teacher. So when you one of the ways you can test people's level of genuine interest is say, here's a teaching you can listen to. And they go, no, I just want you to tell me. Well, if you really want to know, this is the best way to get the answer. And they don't really want to know most of the time. Okay, next.
Tiffany Henderson, when someone asks me questions and I point them either to rabbi or to a teaching and they later say they didn't watch it, do I stop there?
I'm not really sure I understand, do I stop there? If they don't approach you anymore about the subject, then there's nothing more to do. It's not your... Look, same thing with me. If I recommend you listen to something, I'm not going to pursue to figure out whether or not you listen to it. And like I say all the time, we're not a cult. I will give you information and guidance, and you do or do not. I mean, that's up to you. Whatever you do with it. Now, if somebody comes back to you, Stephanie, after they asked a question and you gave them a teaching and you asked them, did you listen to Rabbi's teaching? And they say no, then you say, well, that's still my only answer is that you should listen to the teaching. Just point them back. We do that all the time. One of the first questions elder will ask somebody is, did you do what we told you last time? If they say no, then the answer is go back and do what we told you last time, then give us a call if you still need help, right? One of the things hopefully you guys who have said how safe we make people feel, one of the reasons should be because our answers don't change. Okay? You're not going to ask me something today, and next time you ask me, it's going to be different. The answers never change. You can count on it. Okay? And so, look, and I'm such a weird creature of habit. I may say, when you hear me in the teaching, I'll use the exact same words, even though I don't have it written down anywhere, but I, you know. Because that's the consistent way that I see it, you know? All right? The opening blessing, although I said it a slightly different today, most Sabbaths when we start and after the praise is done, I say almost the exact same words every week. I don't have it written down anywhere. I just said it once, liked it, it stuck. And so, you know, all of the teachings that way, all the guidance is that way. So, Stephanie, unless they bring it up, that's where you stop. Okay? Next.
All right, from Sarah Rush, how does one shed fear and anxiety when life experiences and work all constantly reinforce worry and concern and anxiety as an effective and successful method for anticipating and meeting challenges?
No, listen, I'm only making that sort of sigh because I find the fear anxiety questions the hardest for me to answer because I don't do that, right? So I can't relate. So I'm not judging or I'm not trying to be condescending. I really wish I knew better how to help you with this because I don't play in that park, so to speak, okay? I don't play in that playground. Look, when you say, how does one shed the fear and anxiety when life's experiences and work all constantly reinforce worry? What do you mean they reinforce worry? These are all choices. Stuff is always happening around you that you could be concerned about. Concern is not worried. Concern is being aware that something potentially could be a problem, which means that you may have to have an awareness so that you can make adjustments and stuff. Okay, worry is a fear of what might happen. A concern is I'm concerned something might happen, which means I may have to be doing certain things to be prepared in case it does. Worry is a fear of it happening. Anxiety is a fear of something that hasn't happened yet happening. okay, or not happening. It could be either one. You could have anxiety about something not happening, right? Like not getting a promotion, not getting a raise, not getting something, right? And so when you want to know, you know, how do you shed the fear? I hate to say it as simply as this. Just let it go. We'll have Agnes sing the song for you. Let it go, let it go, all right? You have to stop worrying and listen to the teaching fear of Yahweh as many times as you need to. Because if you can understand that's the only fear you're supposed to have and you won't be afraid of anything else again, that teaching is designed to fix this, okay? But when you say something about these things as being an effective and successful method for anticipating and meeting challenges, no. Anxiety and fear are not successful methods for anticipating meeting challenges. Awareness and having concern is effective. Okay? If I'm listening to a weird sound in my car, I may have a concern that something's happening with whatever it is, whatever I think the sound is. Like, say it sounds like the brakes maybe. I have a concern the brakes may be going. So that concern is nothing to be afraid of. I just may bring it to the mechanic and ask him to check it. So I have a concern that something may adversely happen, right? An adverse thing may happen. It's a concern. I mean, I'm actually aware and want it not to happen or want to mitigate it in some way, so I'm going to take some action. So yes, concern is an effective way to anticipate and then meet challenges. Fear is a terrible way to do that. Anxiety, these are all things that will disempower any way to meet the challenges. Okay? All right? You have a job situation. You find out that the company's not doing so well and they're laying off some people. Guess what? You should be concerned that you're going to lose your job. Concerned, not afraid, not worried, no anxiety, but that concern should lead you to look for a plan B because there's a chance you're going to lose your job. I mean, you can see the writing on the wall. And so once you can see that, you should be concerned, which it should motivate you to do something to meet the challenge, to mitigate the problem. But you need to see the difference between being aware of something which causes a concern, okay? In other words, I'm now thinking, I could lose my job. I'm not afraid of that. I just need to start doing the things necessary to prepare for that. Or I could be like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm going to lose my job, and then I won't be able to pay my bills, and blah, blah. Okay. Or you could roll into a ball and suck your thumb, right, in a fetal position or something. I mean, the cure to these things is don't be afraid, no anxiety. Just be aware and make adjustments. Be aware and make adjustments. Okay? All right. Okay. Anything else?
I'll give one more here. From Jean Jordan. If no man can tame his tongue, and you're equating it to thoughts and desires, how can man cast down vain imagination and transform his own mind?
All right, I've covered this on a lot of teachings in different places. When we understand how thoughts work and then they connect to emotion and how those emotions then lead to manifest into actions and those kind of things. It all starts with you being, and I haven't said this in a long time, hyper-vigilant awareness of yourself. You have to have hyper-vigilant awareness of yourself, which includes what are you thinking and what are you feeling, all right? So then you may have imaginations. You may have vain imaginations. You may have very creative imaginations. You may have just entertaining imagination, okay? But you have to be aware of what are your thoughts and your emotions going to manifest into action. Is it an action that you want to be manifested? Because when we start taking actions on a regular basis, they become what we call a habit. And the habits turn into a destiny, okay? They take you somewhere. You end up somewhere in life based on your habits. And so, you know, when I say that no man can tame his tongue, you can't tame the tongue in the flesh. But if you connect with the above, which is the wisdom I'm giving you right now, is if you're hyper aware of how you're thinking and feeling, you can tame the lusts and the desires, which is the idea of taming the tongue. Okay? So it's not that you can't tame the tongue. The flesh can't tame the tongue. If you're in the flesh, in the below, in the earthly, because that part doesn't want to tame the tongue. It's just lashing out all over the place. All right? It's, by the way, this is like why so many of you refuse to submit to my guidance to not text, post, or any of those things when you're in a negative emotional space. But see, you're in the flesh at that moment. And so you're not taming the tongue, in which case the tongue is actually you typing it out. All right, you're not actually speaking, but you're speaking through texting. But you will not receive that. So many of you come to us and you're all kinds of trouble because you sent a post or a text that you shouldn't have sent because you were mad and your feelings were hurt or whatever it was. See, that's a flesh moment, and you are not able to tame things in a flesh moment. You have to shift to an above thinking. You're in the flesh, you're all upset, then you have to reconnect to the above, which is what I told Ashley, go calm down. And then before, so never post when you're upset. Never text anybody when you're upset. Calm down first. Don't call people when you're upset. Okay? You don't do things that could really get you in trouble when you're upset. You got to calm down first. Because then you may regret, or then you may be able to adjust and not do something you may regret later. Because now that you're calm, you may say, I'm glad I didn't send that text. I'm glad I didn't make that phone call. Because maybe when you calm down, you realize you either misinterpreted what happened, or you realize maybe you were at fault, or you realize if you'd done and blasted the person, whatever you wanted to do, it may have done more damage than really was what you wanted to do at that point, right? Okay? So the man is not able to tame the tongue only while man is in the flesh, meaning flesh thinking. I'm not saying like we're human, okay? But if we can connect vertically, which means we must have the peace, the calm, the compassion, all the things that were in verse 17, right? James 3:17. Then in that calm space, we can connect to the above, and then we can tame the tongue. All right, anything else? That was it, we're good? All right, hope that was good for everybody.